On this episode of Know How, you'll know how to revive your dead hard drive, do premise wiring, and oh, we answer your questions about FreeNAS.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know How is brought to you by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want, with access to over 2,000 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/knowhow. That's LYNDA.com/knowhow. And by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code KNOWHOW to receive $10 off at checkout. Welcome to Know How. It's the show where we build, break, upgrade, and overall geek out over the tech. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, and in the next 30 minutes, we're going to show you some interesting projects and give you the knowledge to geek out on your own. But first, we've got a quick tip. See, we did an episode on FreeNAS last week, and a few of you really liked it, but you had a couple of questions about how you set it up and how you maintain it, how you might upgrade it. But first, we're going to start with the flash drive. We got a lot of really good feedback surrounding our FreeNAS segment with Patrick Norton in episode 78 of Know How. One of those sets of questions hovered around the USB flash drive, the USB key that I suggested you install your FreeNAS operating system on. So the first question was, why a flash drive? Why not a hard drive, or why not an SSD? Well, the most obvious question is the waste of space. You see, the way that the FreeNAS operating system works is that even though it's only 2 gigabytes, you can only use the drive for that. You can't partition it out. You can't use the space for anything else. You can't store anything on there other than the FreeNAS operating system. So it doesn't matter if it's a 2 gigabyte drive, a 4 gigabyte drive, 128 gigabyte SSD, or a 2 terabyte rotating media drive. You can only use the first 2 gigabytes, and why would you do that? The other thing is about longevity. You see, when you've got data on a rotating drive, that drive is slowly shaking itself to death. It's not going to happen for a really long time, but eventually the rotating drive will fail simply because it has moving parts. With an SSD, you're just wasting space, but with a flash drive, what will happen is you actually only use up its life when you write to the drive, which doesn't actually happen a lot when you're using FreeNAS. So, in fact, a flash drive is going to last longer than a rotating media drive. Now, let's move on. Some people have asked, well, I don't like having this drive on the outside of the case. Is there something I can do to secure it? They're afraid that someone might accidentally pull it while FreeNAS is in operation, and they don't like the fact that it kind of sticks out from the case. They want something more secure. Some people have suggested buying a USB extension cable and maybe taping the drive to the case, but that's a little ghetto, and let's make it a little bit better than that. You see, there are things on your motherboards called USB headers. It's what allows your motherboard to connect to the USB ports on your case so that you don't just have the USB ports on the back, in the back of the motherboard. Well, not all of those headers are full, and if they're not, you can use something like this. This is just a standard USB header extension cable that I pulled off of a dead case. You could also buy these on the internet. They typically cost less than a dollar. They're really cheap, but what they'll allow you to do is to use one of those unused headers on your motherboard. Simply connect the cable to one of the empty USB headers, and then connect the flash drive into your new found port. You should now have something that looks like this, that's connected to your motherboard. This assembly can be secured inside your case. You could use a Velcro tie strap, you could use a tie down, or like me, you could go ahead and hot glue it to the bottom of the case to ensure that it won't move around. While you're at it, why not put a dab of hot glue around the USB key to make sure that it stays in the port even if the box gets moved? Follow these steps and you're well on your way to FreeNAS Nerdvana. Now, I hope that you make it to Nirvana on your own. The nice thing about using flash drives is, of course, most of us have a lot of them. And yes, they do last a long time. I think that was the number one question I got, which is, well, aren't you worried about putting things on a flash drive? But as I said, flash memory is only used up. It's only worn out by the writes. And something like FreeNAS isn't going to write a whole lot to the flash drive. It's pretty much a live CD, something that just pulls and then writes configurations to the flash drive. In that case, it's going to last a long, long time. And we're happy to bring you that knowledge. Now, speaking of knowledge, I want to take a moment to recognize one of the sponsors of Know How. And they're a great sponsor because they're all about knowledge. You want to know, they want to teach you. And of course, I'm speaking about Lynda.com. Now, Lynda is an online learning company, but they've got a difference. You see, what do you want to learn this year? Photography, audio and video editing, software skills. With the easy-to-follow video tutorials on Lynda.com, you can learn at your own pace, on your own terms, from top industry experts. With a Lynda.com subscription, members receive unlimited access to thousands of online video courses that cover a variety of software, creative, and business skills. Now, personally, I've been using Lynda.com to brush up on my Adobe Premiere Pro skills. The nice thing about Lynda.com is that you don't have to start at the beginning. So you don't have to go through 3 days of material that is for a beginner where you might be intermediate or advanced. Instead, you can jump straight to the chapters that help you either learn or relearn the skills that you need to complete the project that you're working on. That's one of the things that I use Lynda for. It's not just a learning company. It's a company that helps you with reference on things you already know. I just like that. Now, you can improve your skills, learn new software, and keep up with technology with Lynda.com. They have over 2,000 courses with new courses added daily. And their new courses include things like lighting design for video production, responsive typography, Google Analytics, and Google AdWords Essential Training. The instructors are working professionals at the top of their fields and expert teachers. You get high-quality video production from state-of-the-art studios. These aren't the homemade videos that you'll find on YouTube where the camera is a little shaky and the audio is absolutely horrible and you've got these boring long cuts. These are people who actually know what they have to do to make you learn the information you want to know. They get curated course content. Each Lynda.com course is carefully structured so that users can learn from start to finish or, again, jump to a specific chapter for the quick answers that you need. The easy-to-follow videos can help you find the answers you need, especially with searchable transcripts that allow you to search inside a video to save time and find exactly what you're looking for. So you're not just guessing based on the titles of the chapters. You could ask Lynda, show me jump cut, Premiere, and they'll take you to the chapter that actually shows you how to properly do a jump cut. The courses are for all experience levels, and they cover a wide range of technical skills, creative techniques, business strategies, and more. You can watch from your computer, your tablet, or your mobile device, and you can switch and pick up on the chapter where you left off. So if you want to start learning on your desktop and move to your laptop and then end up on your phone or your tablet, it's all easy. You get to learn at your own pace, on your own schedule. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to learn something new in 2014 with Lynda.com. It's only $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com course library. Or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's projects using the exact same assets. And you can try Lynda.com right now with a free 7-day trial. Visit Lynda.com/knowhow to access the entire library. That's over 2,000 courses free for 7 days. They've also created a playlist with some suggested courses to get you started. It's all at Lynda.com. That's Lynda.com/knowhow. And we thank Lynda for their support of Know How. Now let's get to it. I promised you some hard drive revival, and who among us hasn't experienced some drive failure? I like to say that there's really two types of users. There are those who have lost data on a hard drive and those who are going to lose data. So let's take a look. So, your drive is dead. Well, the first step is don't panic. No, seriously, don't panic. The worst thing you could possibly do is to start flying off the handle, going crazy, breaking out your Dremel, throwing your computer down the hallway. Take a breath, step away, acknowledge that it just happened, and then come back with a fresh head. That is, of course, unless you have an SSD or a flash drive, because, your data's gone and you should probably go ahead and panic. No, I'm just kidding. But no, seriously, your data is gone. All right, now assuming that you've got a rotating drive, the second step is to evaluate. And by evaluate, I mean take a look at the variables here. Is the drive under warranty? Because that's going to affect whether or not you start messing around with the hardware if it's going to invalidate the warranty. The second thing is, what is on the drive? Is there a backup? Even if it's an old backup, if you can, you know, get a step up on starting the project over, it's kind of preferable to some of the stuff that I'm going to have you go through. So make a list of all the things that are on the drive that you can't get anywhere else and decide for yourself if it's worth the time and the trouble and the aggravation to get it back. Now, I'm assuming that you've gotten to this point and you said, yes, yes, I am calm, and yes, yes, I do need the stuff on the hard drive. So let's move to step three. Step three is basic troubleshooting. Get into the case and start moving the drive around. Try out the cables. Maybe swap cables to a different power cable, a different SATA cable. Get rid of all the things that could be causing a bad drive other than a bad drive. Switch to a different SATA port. Use a different SATA cable. Switch to a different power port. Use a different power supply or an external power supply if you happen to have one. If you are absolutely sure that it's the drive and nothing else in the motherboard, then try it in a different computer. That's assuming, of course, that you have another system that's available. Again, what we're trying to do is get rid of all the other factors and narrow the problem down to your dead drive. Okay, now we're assuming that, yes, you do have a dead drive. I need you to do a bit of triage on it. Plug it in and have a listen. Is it spinning? Can you feel the platters moving? It gets harder to actually move the drive because you've got rotating mass. Do you hear a clicking sound? Does it sound like it's trying to power up, but then it can't quite make it? You hear the It sounds silly, but these are all clues to what's going on with your drive. Essentially, what we're trying to do now is narrow down the problem to either a mechanical problem or a controller problem. Is it the drive itself? Let's say a bearing has gone bad, or a shaft is bent, or has expanded past the tolerances, or has the controller board gone up, belly up? These are the sort of clues that you're going to need to move on to the next step, because the next step is starting with software. The reason why I start with a software tool is because it doesn't yet invalidate any warranty, and it doesn't yet really require you to do anything other than download a piece of software. In my case, I always start with SpinRite, created by Steve Gibson, who actually is on Security Now on the Twit TV network. You can see it running right now in the background. I actually do a system check on my computers every month or so just to make sure that my storage devices are still okay. What SpinRite can do is, as long as your drive is still recognized by the computer, as long as it has some sort of access, it can take a seemingly dead drive and bring it back to life, at least enough for you to get your data off. Now, let's assume that SpinRite doesn't work. Either it can't find your drive, or let's just say it gave up. It says, now that this drive is too far gone. The next step is to consider a logical failure. Now, the logical failure would be that problem if the drive is actually spinning, but maybe it's not detected. You go into your BIOS, you go into your setup screen, you go into your control manager, your system manager, your storage manager, and you can't find the drive. Well, in that case, maybe it's just the logical board fault, and you can replace that and get it back. Here's the problem. Logic boards are not universal. Even on the same model of hard drive, even on the same revision of hard drive, you can get different types of controllers, and, well, if they're not compatible, it's not going to work properly. When I buy my hard drives, I always buy them in a set. In fact, these are, 1.5 gigabyte Seagate Barracuda 7200 RPM drives that I used in a NAS array a while back. I bought, I believe, 10 of these at the same time. What that does is, of course, it gives me a lot of drives for my network-attached storage boxes, but it also gives me the ability to swap over controller cards from hard drives that most likely came out of the same batch. That gives me a little extra assurance. Now, if you can't have that, if you didn't buy a set of drives when you bought your hard drive, look for something as close as possible. You need the same model, you need the same make. It'd be nice if you could get the same year or the same month of manufacture. That's really how tight these tolerances run. This is a very low percentage operation, but for some people who are desperate, it's going to be worth the go. To use this technique, you're going to need the dead drive and then a drive that is compatible. You're also probably going to need a toolkit that includes, say, like the T drivers. Most of these hard drives aren't going to use standard Phillips or flat screws. Go ahead and remove the controller from the dead drive, and then do the same thing for the live drive. If they're the same make and model, you should just be able to swap the controller board from the live drive onto your dead drive and refasten the screws. Now you've got the formerly dead drive along with the live logic board, and what we can do is connect this to the computer and see if it is now recognized in BIOS, in my case, and in my software manager. If it is, if you can find the drive, the first thing you want to do is copy everything off. We're assuming that this is a temporary fix. In fact, all of these things, be it SpinRite, this, or the next solution, are temporary fixes designed to help you get the data off, not to revive the drive. We're just going to assume the drive is dead. If that doesn't work, if the drive isn't spinning and therefore the electrical replacement is just not going to work, there is one more thing that you can try. Now, you can read about this on the internet. There are pros and cons. There are people who say this is absolute poppycock. There are others who swear by it. I'm going to show you a really good way to freeze your drive. The success rate of freezing your drive is mostly anecdotal. People say that it works, and sometimes it has. In fact, it has worked for me, so I can't really knock the solution if it's saved me some data. But the main idea is you take a drive and you throw it in the freezer, and somehow, some way, either because the spindle shrinks or because it changes the thrust of the rotating media, somehow the drive starts spinning again, and then you can plug it into your computer and get your data off. Now, here's the problem. Take something metal, like a hard drive. Now freeze it. Now take it out of that frozen environment, and what's going to happen? Well, you're going to get condensation. In a place like San Francisco, I don't really worry about that. But if you're in, say, a humid climate or in the summer where you're going to get a lot of condensation, well, that's a non-starter from the go. You're going to kill the drive the moment that condensation starts to form and get into your circuit pathways. So here's a little thing that I call a hard drive burrito. What you need is a Ziploc bag, a towel, and then the drive and some extension cable, something for SATA and something for the power adapter. In my case, I've actually used a SATA to old-style power adapter, and then I've used a SATA to eSATA connector so that I get this nice little pigtail. Connect the extension cords to the hard drive, then put the hard drive into the towel and wrap it up into a nice little burrito. Go ahead and put the burrito into the Ziploc bag and try to squeeze out as much air as possible. Once you've got the shape that you want, tape around the bag to help squeeze out some of the additional air, and then zip up the bag. If you're a little OCD like myself, and you don't like the fact that there's an outlet where the cords come out of the Ziploc bag, go ahead and put some hot glue into that hole, and it will seal it up just quite nicely. Now take the entire burrito and place it into the freezer for 24 hours. After 24 hours, take the burrito back out of the freezer and plug it into power and into an eSATA connector connecting it to your computer. Now comes the moment of truth. We want to know if the burrito will connect to your computer. Go ahead and start up the computer and check the BIOS, check your device manager, check your storage manager to see if the drive comes back. If you hear the drive spinning and if you can see it in your storage manager, congratulations, you've got a new lease on life. Now, again, this is a temporary fix. This isn't intended to make this drive usable again. It's intended to give you a couple of minutes, a couple of hours to get as much data off of it as possible. Do it now, and assume that the drive is dead. Now, this burrito will only keep condensation from destroying the drive immediately, but in most cases, freezing the drive will be a one-shot deal. Once you've frozen it and started it up, just assume that condensation has formed on the platters the minute that it shuts down, and it will never start again. Once you move past the software layer, it gets really iffy. In fact, I'd say that the recovery rate hovers somewhere down in the 20% range. For my logic switch, I had, remember, a set of 10 of these drives, and only one of them was compatible. So the odds of you finding a compatible logic board are actually quite small. I would say don't do this unless you've got a lot of drives hanging around or unless you really, really want to see it work. In that case, knock yourself out. The thing with the freezing is I always tell people don't do it. Don't do it, don't do it, unless it is absolutely, positively your last resort. And if you do not intend to send the drive off to like Drive Savers or some drive recovery service. It is really the last thing your drive will ever do, so if you're going to do it right. I'm Father Robert Ballester, and now that you learned, go freeze your data. All of us are going to go through some data disaster at some point in our geek lives. In fact, you've probably already gone through one. I know that I have. I back up pretty religiously. I'm always making sure that I've got three copies in two different locations on, you know, different types of media. But the problem is, in between backups, that's normally when disaster's going to strike. Now, Brian, my yes? cranky hippo, my TD, have you ever had a data disaster?
I have. I had an external hard drive, a 250 gig one that died a couple years ago.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the most common. You've got that portable drive that goes with you, especially if you're, say, doing video production, that you keep all your shots, all your B-roll, all your video, all your audio. And the problem is, if it's something that's unique, that you can't replace, that you can't just rework like a document, well, then that's when you're going to go through all the trouble. But I will say, please, don't just assume that you can follow these steps and, oh, everything's going to be fine. In fact, I specifically said in the video that those are very low percentage recovery options. This only worked because I had 10 drives that were alike. And of the 10 drives, there was only one other drive that had a controller that would work with this dead drive. Now, the worst thing about this is, even though I knew it was just the electronics, I can't just order one from Seagate. They don't work like that. They just say, go ahead and replace the data. So the other thing I'll say is, if you get one of these methods to work, get your data off. I can't say that enough. I have too many stories of people who ran SpinRite once and it started working again, or they tried freezing the drive and they thought everything was good. No, once the drive starts to malfunction, assume that it's a data black hole, and anything you put on there is going to die. Brian, do you agree? Is that okay with you?
Yeah, and just a reminder to back up everything. I think the last straw for my external hard drive was it fell off my desk. So it hit the ground, and then it just stopped working. So back up.
I think we call that problem PEBCAC.
Yeah? What does that stand for, Padre?
I don't know. We'll have to look that one up.
I think
now,
I know.
Before we move on to the next segment, which is going to be me showing you how to do proper premise wiring, how to wire up your house or your office, how to do it right and how to do it with standards, why don't we take some time to talk about the next sponsor of Know How, and that's LegalZoom.com. Now, some things like starting a business or protecting your family with a will aren't like your other New Year's resolutions. You know, it's not just going to the gym or losing weight or stopping drinking soda. And, oh, my God, I love soda. You can't afford to blow them off. Instead of less snacking and more exercise, put these important resolutions at the top of your list. Take them seriously. And LegalZoom helps. You see, LegalZoom helps you incorporate or form an LLC with their simple questionnaire, starting at just $99. Over 1 million entrepreneurs have already done it, and 90% of customers recommend LegalZoom to friends or family. They're not a fly-by-night, one-shot, get-your-money-and-run type company. They put out a product that people actually like, that people actually use. That's hard to do in this industry. And you can also create a will starting at just $69 or even a living trust quickly and easily and get peace of mind and protection. In other words, what LegalZoom will do is take all those hard decisions in life and give you a template to make sure that you're taken care of and your family is taken care of as well. There are no surprise fees, no hassles, and no headaches. LegalZoom's step-by-step process was created by a team of experts in law and technology. What that means is that you're not going to get a bunch of legalese. You're going to get contracts that you understand. You're going to get language that's in English. You're going to get protection and at the same time understand what you're putting your signature on. LegalZoom isn't a law firm, but they can connect you with third-party attorneys and provide you with self-help services, from wills to business formation, trademarks, power of attorney, and more. For everything, go to LegalZoom.com. Now, here's what I want you to do. I know that the know-it-alls, that the know-how crowd, that our audience are smart individuals, geeks of the highest level. But maybe we need a little help when it comes to the law. So why not visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs, like wills for $69, LLCs for $99 plus filing fees, and also get access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. Don't put off the things you need to do. Go to LegalZoom.com now and use discount code KNOWHOW. That's LegalZoom.com, discount code KNOWHOW, to receive $10 off at checkout. And we thank LegalZoom for their support of KNOWHOW. Now, let's get to it. Many of you have dabbled with wiring. In fact, I've seen some pictures of wiring out there. let me say that when you're dealing with networks, electrical tape is never, never acceptable. We want to use a standard. And I know a lot of people are saying, wait a minute, as long as I have the same patching on either side of the cable, everything should be good. And technically, that's true. But what I want to do is I want to teach you the method that the rest of the industry uses, that everyone uses, so you can make sure to do it right in your home or in your office. We want you to be able to cut open a cable that you may have bought at the store, plug it in, and have it work just fine on your network because you're using the same wiring schematic. It sounds trivial, but this is actually pretty important. Now, the first thing you're going to need are your tools. Now, if you switch to my desk shot here, you'll see some of the tools that I typically use for my premise wiring. You don't need all of this stuff. This is just the stuff that I have in my toolkit anytime I go out to do some wiring. Of course, I'm going to have my tester. This is a toner, IntelliToner from Fluke Networks. The reason why I like this is it allows me to do both cable testing. So watch, if I take a cable here, and I know this one's good, I've tested it before, and I plug it into my into the receptacles of the tester, I can run what's called a cable map, which essentially means, if you listen closely,
Fluke Network.
It's running a cable map to see if all those connectors are right. And if I'm getting that tone, that dink tone, and I'm seeing the lights here on the tester, it means that, yeah, all eight of my conductors are going through just fine. They're in the right order, and there are no breaks in the cable. This would be a good cable, and this is a good way to test. Now, you need something like this because, well, there is no really other way to test. Some people I know just plug a device in. They plug their laptop in once they're done with the cable, and if it works, that's fine. But that'll really only tell you if two of the pairs are working. It won't tell you if there's anything that's out of order. It won't tell you if there's any shorts that are just connected. You need something like a tester to be able to do that right. Now, you don't have to buy an expensive one. Fluke tends to be a bit on the pricier side. But get something that's easy enough for you to read. Another one of the testers that I use quite a bit, this is a Fluke Net Tool. They don't actually make these anymore, but I like them because they're small. This is just like the IntelliTool in that it can test continuity. But the other thing that it can do is it's actually a full-on network tester. It will do auto tests to let you know whether or not the cable is working properly. But it can test your DHCP servers. It can ping out. It could look to see if the network switch is actually operating at 10, 100, or gigabit. If you do a lot of premise wiring, consider getting one of these testers because it's a level above what you get with a simple toning tool and cable map. Also, one more thing that you can do with these testers is you can do what's called a tone. So let's say you've got a bundle of cable, you know, the big umbilical coming out of your ceiling or out of your floor, out of the wall, whatever it might be, and you're not really sure which cable is the one that you're supposed to be playing with. You're supposed to be troubleshooting. What you can do is just go ahead and plug in this side, the toner side, into the signal generator, into one side of the cable. And then this acts as a sort of a pickup, see? It'll actually, as I get closer to that source, it will start making noise to let me know, okay, that's the cable I should be looking for. It's a very useful tool if you're dealing with a big premise setup. All right, let's get past the testing tools. Let's move on to the hardware. This is what we like. I typically like two different types of crimpers. This is sort of the old style. You'll find this really cheaply on eBay and most electronic stores. You could probably get this for under $10. It's really simple. It's got a stripping element here, a cable cutter, and then it's got a crimping tool. Both of these use a crimping tool die. This one is a bit higher end. This one actually probably cost me about $150 because it has interchangeable die. So I could use this with different size plugs. The reason why you need this is because we're going to be doing what's called crimping. We're going to be crimping connectors onto the ends of cables to make sure that they stay. Now, it's not just crimping that we're going to be doing. We're going to be playing with stuff like this. These are what are called punch-down jacks. And just like the name might indicate, you punch down the wires into these little grooves, and then you cut off the excess cable. That could be a pain in the butt if it were not for this. This is a bladed impact tool. The idea is really simple. I don't know if you can zoom in on this. Probably not. I'll just show you. On one side, you've got a flat iron. On the other side, you've got a blade. When I push this down into one of these receptacles, it will push the cable into the blade that's within the socket. And then when you hear that noise, it actually cuts the excess wire so that you get a nice, clean punch down. You can actually see what I've done right here. This is what it looks like when we're all done. Okay, so now we've got our tools. We've got our stripping tools. We've got our snips. We've got our testing tools. Let's get to the action. The first thing we're going to need is a length of cable. I've got a standard box of Category 5E. This is TwitTech cable. You just pull out whatever length you need. If you're doing premise wiring, what I would normally suggest is get as many boxes as you're going to be doing runs. So, for example, if I'm wiring up my bedroom and I want 4 runs from my bedroom down to my wiring closet, I don't want to do it 4 times. I'm going to get 4 boxes of cable, tape them together, and then run it as one so that it cuts down on the amount of work that I have to do. I'm going to go ahead and snip off whatever length of cable that I need. And a few quick things about this type of cable. This is Category 5E, which will go up to, I believe it's 100 meters, so close to 1,000 feet for a single run. What that means is you have to go only up to 100 meters between devices, so between switches, between computer and the switch, or the computer and a repeater and a switch, or a computer and an access point. If you go beyond that, the signal degrades too much. And the other thing to remember is it's not infinite. It's not like, okay, well, as long as I get it at 100 meters, everything will be fine. As you get closer to the limit of the cable, your speed will drop off. The reliability of the signal will drop off. So you kind of want to make the run as short as possible. I tell you this because if you got a tester like this net tool. The net tool will actually let me know how much cable is paid out. So I can plug one side in and make sure that I don't have more than 100 meters. More than that, I can test speed over that length of cable, and it will tell me, okay, at 90 meters, you're getting a 30% drop off of speed. Is there any way you can chop 10 meters off of that and get half of that back? That's kind of important when you're doing premise wiring. Let's get down to the actual wiring itself. We've got here a cable that I made just before the show. This is using the 865, or I always forget exactly what it's called. It's the T568B wiring schematic. This is the one that most people around the world use. This is the one that any cable you buy in the store is going to use. So this is the one that I'm going to teach you. When you open up a length of Category 5 cable, it's going to look a little bit like this. So I'm going to take my tool here. I've got a little stripping segment. I'm going to go ahead and take maybe about 1.5 inches off the outer insulation. When I do that, I see that there are actually 4 bundles of wires in here. There's orange and white, there's green and white, blue and white, and brown and white. I'm sorry that doesn't show up really well on the camera, but you're just going to have to trust me. There's also typically a piece of fiberglass. This is just to strengthen the cable to help it endure any stress. Go ahead and snip that off. We're not going to need that. It just gets in the way during the wiring. Now, the reason why these are pairs is because they're a twisted pair. There's 2 conductors here that have been twisted together along the entire length of the cable. The reason why you do that is because a twisted pair has less signal drop-off than just standard conductors. Not only that, they're less likely to take interference from an antenna. What we want to do is we want to grab one of these heads. So this is a wiring head. This allows me to turn this into a cable. And I need to remember this order. I want white-orange, orange. White-green, blue. White-blue, green. White-brown, brown. Just go Google the standard and you'll be able to find these graphics all over the place. This is the order that you need to put these conductors into the cable head. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and untwist it and get my cable into that order. So here we have white, orange, and orange. I'm going to untwist white, green, and green. And then untwist white, blue, and blue. And see, this is the one that always gets people messed up. It sounds like it should be white, orange, orange, white, green, green. No, it's white, orange, orange, white, green, blue, white, blue, then green, white, brown, and then brown. And the reason why they did that, again, is because when they created the standard, they wanted something that had really low crosstalk, and at the same time, they wanted something that wouldn't be easy to mess up. Go ahead and straighten out your conductors and get something that looks a little bit like this. These conductors are all in the right order. And I want to snip. I want to take my snips and cut them right about there. So just about 1 inch out. And now I've got a nice straight cut across the top. I can take my head and I can just push it in. So when you're doing this, make sure that you're looking at the pins. You want to be looking at the pins, not at the clip. Look at the pin of the cable head. Go ahead and push that in. Make sure that the insulation makes it to this bottom part, because there's a little clamp that's going to hold it to make sure that it stays in there. And then just take your crimping tool and give it a couple squeezes. Now, this is where this tool is kind of okay. If you're going to use this tool, you kind of have to do it a few times. You have to move down the length and make sure that it's engaged the pins. Those pins actually push into the conductors. Why this is nicer is because this makes sure that it gets all the conductors at the same time. If I put it into this one and ratchet it down, you can actually hear it. And now I'm good. This head is now firmly on, and it's using the right standard. If I were to go ahead and put the other head onto the cable, I could then plug it into my cable tester like I did before, and I should hear... Oh, 1 second, let it run. There you go. So I get my 8 tings. That means all 8 conductors are in the right place, and they're in the right order. Of course, if you go back to my why, this only shows you how to do this. This shows you how to make your own cables, which is nice because now I can make pretty much a limitless supply of these cables rather than buying them for $5, $10, $20 a pop. Please, whatever you do, if you're a true know-it-all, don't go down to Monster Cable and buy their $40 cables. They're not going to do you any good. But the question is, how do I go from that to this? This is what we call a patch panel. The reason why we want to do this is because when we're wiring our house, we want a system that is really easy to patch between devices. If I use a cable, and if I just run from this computer to this computer to that switch, it becomes a jumble of cables. If I run everything down to a central location and then put all of those cables into a patch panel, it makes it really easy for me to decide which rooms plug into which switch. Like, for example, maybe I have one switch for data, one switch for voice if I don't have a converged network. Maybe I want to use a few of those for security cameras and I want them on their own private network. A patch panel gives you the maximum amount of flexibility to wire your home or your office the way you want to do it. Now, the way you do it is just like I showed you with the cable. So you're gonna separate a length of cable. You're going to go ahead and strip it. So you want to do the same thing. All the steps are going to be the same up to that. Strip off a piece of the outer insulation so that you can expose the internal conductors. Go ahead and snip off the fiberglass strengthening. And then untwist the cables that you need. Now, you'll notice at the bottom here, we have a color code. And the color code will tell you where the cables need to go in. I go from blue to orange to green to brown. I'm going to do the exact same thing that I did with my plug, but instead of snipping them off and pushing them into the conductor head, I'm instead going to put them into these individual blades. I'm going to match up the colors with the cables that go into the colors, if I can get my fingers to work properly. And then I'm going to use the impact tool to punch them and cut them. I'm going to cut them all to length, and everything will be nice and happy. Now, here's one of the things that really, really pro users will do. You want to try to maintain the twist for as long as possible. If you can, don't untwist everything, because if you untwist a whole inch of conductor, you're gonna see signal drop off. Now, for most of your homes, it's not gonna matter, but if you are doing something for your office, just, you know, make sure to do it the right way. So in this case, I'm going white, blue, and then orange, and then I go to green, and then I go to brown. Let's get my orange in here. This is always fun. Once I've got the conductors in place, now remember, when you're doing this, you're typically going to have a lot of conductors. This is not just a one-off. If you're wiring your house, you're going to have a load of conductors in there, and it's you know, make sure you keep them nice and neat. So I get something that looks like this with all these cables sticking out. I can now take my impact tool, make sure that it's blade out. So here's the blade on this side. I'm going to flip it around, make sure that the blade is on the outside of the patch panel, and go ahead and punch these down. And as it punches down, you'll see that it's actually cutting off the excess cable. And as it cuts off the excess cable, it keeps everything at a nice length, and it makes sure that you don't have any additional copper conductors that could possibly short-circuit your installation. Now, again, the reason why we're doing this is because we want a maximum amount of flexibility. We don't just want a single cable running to every device. We want the ability to repatch as our needs change. Let's give the screen one more. There we go. And now I get a nice, clean patch panel. This, if you go back to my white, is how you should be wiring your house, your home, or your office. Now, we're going to be doing more on this because this is really, really basic stuff. But you can get a bit more advanced in how you run your network, including using stuff like this. This is crazy, crazy Category 6. This stuff is thick. I mean, it looks like a hose. But this will allow you to run 10 gig over Ethernet. Now, that's all we've got for this episode of Know-How. I'm sorry, we've actually run out of time. No, seriously, we've completely run out of time. But if there was anything from this show that you want to know about, please go to our show notes page. That's where you can find everything about everything. You can find it at twit.tv/KH. Right next to every episode, you'll see a list of all the projects that we did and the individual steps that we took to make it work. Also, did you know that we've got a social media presence? Yeah, that's right. We're social media. We don't do that email thing. If you want to find out what's going on in the know-how community, if you want to talk to our know-it-alls, why not drop off to our Google Plus page? It's almost got 6,000 users, and they're very, very active. Drop on by to gplus.to/twitkh, and you'll be able to talk to the people who make the show run. I'm always in there. Shannon's always in there. Brian Cranky Hippo is going to be in there, and we'll answer your questions and ask for your advice on what projects we should be covering next. As long as you're going to drop by our G Plus page, why not drop by my Twitter page at twitter.com/PadreSJ? If you follow me, you'll find out not just what I'm doing in my next project of know-how, but you'll be able to suggest to me directly what you want to see. Finally, please, please follow us on our RSS feed, subscribe to our podcast in iTunes, and just drop by each and every single week live when we tape the show at 12:30 Pacific time. I'm Father Robert Ballester, and now that you know, go do it.